I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and a warm welcome to the last episode of Book Off in Series 7. A very good episode to go out on, I think. It's the Literary Podcast with a Difference with me, Joe Haddo, and I will be the ringmaster for the upcoming War of the Words, which will ensue between our two guests a little later on. My first guest is an award-winning journalist and author who worked in newspapers and television before becoming a best-selling crime novelist. Here to tell us about his latest book, The Night Gate, it's Peter May. Hello!
Hello there.
And our second guest is the author of Rules for Perfect Murders and The Kind Worth Killing, both Richard and Judy Book Club picks, and here to tell us about his latest thriller, Every Vow You Break. It's Peter Swanson. Hello to you, Peter.
Hello.
We're connecting, I believe, Massachusetts with France and London. Peter.
Yes. Nice to meet you, Peter, in France.
Nice to meet you too. Yeah, we were just having a very interesting discussion about the late Donald Trump.
Yes.
Anything particular that we missed out on? I should say to the listeners, I have left these two fabulous authors waiting. I was a little late, and therefore, you know, you've probably put the world to rights in my absence.
We did. We were sort of talking about. He's not quite late, but he has sort of disappeared off the public consciousness. I mean, he has here in the States for sure. As we said, they removed his Twitter. They took away his megaphone, and that's made a difference. But yeah, and it's an enormous, it's an enormous relief for me anyway. And I think, Peter, you'd say the same thing.
Yeah, I think an enormous relief for everybody all over the world.
And there was a time, a long old time, just a few months ago, where you couldn't move for him, and I don't just mean his Twitter account, but just the mentions of him and the news stories about him, and just everything. And it really, I don't know if we appreciated it at the time, but it really was quite. It was too much, wasn't it?
It totally dominated the news agenda, didn't it? It was just filled our screens day after day. It actually turned me off watching the news. I have been a news junkie all my life, and I just had a belly full of it. Between Brexit and Donald Trump, I'd had enough.
So are you feeling, you probably got it even more than us, Peter Swanson, being in the US, possibly not, but are you sort of feeling a sense of, there's a relief, there's a calmness, there's room for something else?
I was saying earlier that, I watch the PBS NewsHour here, which is our good news program, an hourly news program. And lately, I'm seeing stories on Europe and Africa and South America and other places, because the news hour is not just being sucked up by whatever latest outrage Trump has said or done in pushing the news agenda. So, Trump's been a buffoon in this country for so long, and prior to him running for president, it was pretty easy to not think about Trump for long stretches of time. And then suddenly to have him in your life, where you're literally like, Trump is in your life every day, you can't get away from him. I think we all felt a little like the drunk uncle at the holiday party who never left for 4 years, and not only that, but was running the country or running the household. I mean, you know, it was a surreal thing, and I think we're lucky to be rid of him, and I think we dodged a major bullet because I think if he had responded to COVID with anything resembling competence, which he did not, I think he'd still be president of this country. I mean, he had an opportunity. All he had to do was take that seriously. And the man's a germaphobe. He should have, I'm surprised he didn't. But
surprised maybe, but many of us are relieved that he didn't.
If
there was going to be another 4 years.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm glad you sort of you had the Trump chat, put the world to rights, and now we can leave his stupid Twitter account behind and continue to talk about what we do enjoy, which is books and writing and reading and everything that comes with it. So I'm going to ask you about what you've been reading lately. We're going to do the book off a little bit later on and find out which two books you're putting up against each other. But first, let's talk about your latest work. Peter, I mentioned The Night Gate, and I'm right in thinking this new novel came from being in lockdown. Is that right?
It did, yes. Sadly, because last year I had planned to write a totally different book, which was going to be set on the Norwegian archipelago of Svalbard in the Arctic Circle. And I'd done a lot of prep during the end of 2019 into 2020. I'd really developed my story and my characters. And I had booked my research trip for last May. And I was really looking forward to it. I'd bought all my cold weather clothes, everything, and I was intending to come back in June and write the book across the summer. And of course, along comes the coronavirus, and bingo, the trip gets cancelled. I can't write the book without doing the trip, but the publisher's still looking for a manuscript.
They do that, don't they, the publishers? They do say, where's my manuscript, quite a lot. Well,
they do. They schedule things into, you know. I found myself last June sitting, scratching my head, thinking, what on earth am I going to write? we were in the middle of a lockdown. I couldn't travel for research. And I kind of thought, I've got to write about something that I know about already, set in places that I know. That I can do from home here in France without going anywhere. It was a bit of a tall order, but I eventually came up with an idea which was inspired by a visit my wife and I had made to a local exhibition in the town just along the road from us here the previous year. And it was an exhibition all about the evacuation of the artworks from the Louvre during the war. And what I hadn't known was that, you know, all this stuff had ended up down in this neck of the woods where I live here in southwest France. Most of the artwork going into a chateau just along the road from me here. So we were interested to see this, and we went along and we were browsing the exhibition and suddenly stopped in front of this black and white photograph on the wall of a building that looked very familiar. It was my garage. And I thought, what is my garage doing in this exhibition? So we read the blurb, and it turned out that while most of the artworks had gone into the chateau, there were these huge, huge pieces like the Wedding Feast at Cana by Veronese and the Coronation of Napoleon by David, which were just too big. They had taken them out of their frames and rolled them round wooden poles like telegraph poles for transportation. And they couldn't get them through the doors of the chateau. So they requisitioned my garage, which has this little apartment above it. It's where I'm sitting talking to you right now, because I was in the middle of making it into my kind of creative workspace. And they fed these priceless works of art through the window to my right here and laid along the length of the floor in the entire building. These are priceless works, and I still get kind of goosebumps thinking about it. I'm occupying the same space that these things once occupied, and And it was a great discovery, and I wrote a blog about it, and I got a phenomenal reaction from readers saying, "Oh, this would make a great novel," but you know, at the time I couldn't see what the novel was, I couldn't see what the story was. It's a great little piece for a local newspaper, but you know, what's the story here? But last June, I sat thinking about it and thinking, well, you know, the subject matter interested people. Let's see if I can turn this into some kind of story that works. And the result of that was The Nightgate.
I mean, it's there's so much to talk about there, isn't there? Because it's just such a fascinating start to a, you know, germ of an idea that's led to this book. And we'll come back and talk about the book and how all that's influenced it. Peter, have you been surrounded by priceless art ever in the place that you're living? Or
no, I don't have a story like that. And I was sort of, it's funny hearing Peter talk about research and abandoning a book because you couldn't go on the research trip. I'm sort of I feel like I do almost no research for my books. I just make it up. But so I was sort of like, oh, just you should have just made it up. You make up a fake Norwegian, you know, sounding village. Like the rest of us do.
But then you don't get the research trip perks, you know?
I know.
And I know Peter didn't get to go anyway, but
no, I know. But yeah, no priceless art here. A few old movie posters in my office and that's about it.
And you may not do research, but you do like to set your stories sort of in the same place, or certainly a place that you know, don't you?
Well, I do. I mean, all my books have been set in sort of New England area, so either in Boston or southern Maine or the north coast of Maine. Occasionally, you know, set something in New York City or a couple times in the UK, places I'm familiar with. I mean, I think that's partly, that's partly laziness, which is that it's the area I know well, but I think it's also partly that I feel like I live in a good area for mystery thrillers. Generally the New England area is good. I mean, it's old for America. I mean, it's not old for Europe, but you know, it has an old feel of brick and granite. It's got moody weather. It's got you know,
loads of lighthouses.
Lots of lighthouses. Classic. little islands off the coast, classic mystery trope.
Yeah,
it's got buttoned down townsfolk who, you know, are probably hiding secrets, which is always good. So yeah, it's got a lot of elements. So that's another reason I use this area.
Let's talk about these new books then, specifically the stories. So Peter May, gosh, this is going to get difficult. We should P1 and P2, really, shouldn't we, or something? Peter May, you've already told us how this book came about. Before you tell us just a little bit about the new novel, what is going to happen with the one that you were planning? Is that sort of now a 2022 proposition in the hope that you can get over to Svalbard?
You know, I've been asked about this, not least by my publisher. ideas, I find, have a moment in your mind, in your stream of consciousness. Mm. They're hot at a certain point in time, and that's when you write them. I think if you hold on to an idea too long, it gets cold, you overthink it, it starts to get away from you. And I have a feeling that's what's going to happen with this one, because I'm not going to get to Svalbard this year.
No.
So it would be spring, you know, it would be a year from now before I could get there again. And I just feel that that's not going to happen.
That's fascinating to me, because I get what you're saying, and I sort of agree with it, but I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, you've sort of got so far down the road with it, or I assume you had, because you were saying once you came back you were going to write it. But is it the sort of the passion for it, the enthusiasm for it that's maybe going to run out, or is it just simply because you'll be sitting on it for so long and thinking about it that actually you might just overwrite it, or I don't know what? I'm sort of really fascinated by that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say why. I mean, I think probably I'm the same as most writers. I come up with a lot of ideas. I mean, ideas come all the time, and I jot them down. I think of little developments would this work, and something seems great, you know, at 12 o'clock at night when you've been jotting it down in your book, and you read it again in the morning, you think, oh, how could I possibly have thought that was worth turning into a book? And I kind of feel that that's what's going to happen with the Svalbard story. In a way, I mean, it was the story that I was planning was, it kind of dealt with very contemporary issues, particularly climate change, and that's not going to have gone away. But there were other issues that I wanted to deal with that I'm sure other people are going to have delved into before I ever got around to writing it. I'm not going to say what they are, but just in case I do.
No, of course.
But yeah, I don't know. It just it already feels as if it slipped away from me.
Is this sort of resonating with you, Peter?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean,
is it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think the next book that you're going to write is the book that is taking up space in your brain, that you're sort of, I do a lot of daydreaming about a book prior to writing it. And I don't even, you know, I tend to not even jot down ideas. I try and keep it all up in my head. And that way I figure the sort of cream rises to the top. The stuff that sticks with me is probably the good stuff. Right. So one of the problems is if you started a book a while ago and put it away, you're just not thinking about it anymore. So it's not in your head. Now, I think it can come back. Because I have had the experience where I've started and stopped, but then it sort of comes back into my head and I get ready for a finish, but it doesn't, if you can't force it, if it's not going to happen naturally. So, I mean that, so I'm the exact same way. And similar to Peter, like I get a lot of ideas too. I get constant ideas. So I kind of wait to see which idea beats up the other ideas in my head. And that's the winner. And that's the one that I have to start writing. It's hard to force that.
Yeah. I love that idea of a sort of boxing ring of ideas, just seeing who's the heavyweight champion of them all.
And by the way, most of the ideas are kind of 98-pound weaklings, right, that are, that, you know, sort of wrestling in there. I mean, there's very few heavyweights. I get a lot of terrible ideas, and but that's the thing. I mean, you need a lot of ideas because, you know, you want to get a good one.
Yeah, absolutely right. I'm so glad we covered that because I was sort of quite fascinated. I guess I assumed that if you've had an idea, and you were going to work on it, didn't matter when you sort of picked it up. So that's just really interesting. So Peter, tell us about The Nightgate Den, and we know why it sort of came about and how, but just give us a little tease of the story.
Well, it's a story that takes place in two timelines. First one's contemporary. It involves the murder of a very well-known French art critic in a house in a village, which is 5 minutes away from where I live, called Carignac. It's here in the Lot in southwest France. Because I was, having to work up this story in a hurry, I instead of creating a new character, I dug an old character out of retirement, Enzo McLeod, for whom I'd written a series of six books previously, and he was literally retired, but doing a favor for a friend, he goes to this village of Carignac to look at an area of ground in a park which has been unearthed by a fallen tree to reveal a corpse which is around 70 years old. While he's there, he stumbles across this investigation into a murder which is taking place right next door to the park in this house, this art critic. And he gets involved in the investigation of both. And he soon discovers that there is actually a link between the two, and these two murders divided by 70 years. And that link is the Mona Lisa. And that is what catapults us back into in time to the second story thread, which is set in 1940s occupied France, at a time when both Hitler and his number two Goering independently have their eyes on the Mona Lisa. Hitler, for his super museum that he intends to build in Linz in Austria, his hometown, and Goering greedily for his private collection. And they have set their own art hounds on the trail of the Mona Lisa to secrete her away from French possession during the course of the war. Word of this is leaked out, and de Gaulle in London recruits a young female art student who'd been involved in the packing of the artworks in the Louvre just before the outbreak of war, to basically go back to France and keep the Mona Lisa safe from the greedy hands of Hitler and Goering.
I love it. I just love, there's so much in it, you know, and in both timelines. Was it fun to bring McLeod out of retirement?
Well, actually, it was, because he's kind of similar age to me. Funnily enough, I've aged faster than he has.
We've all aged faster in lockdown. We've all aged faster in lockdown.
But it was fun exploring that sense of what it's like to be in that certain age bracket, and particularly during a period of peril for people in that age group,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
i.e. the pandemic, because that's something I didn't ignore when I wrote the book. I mean, it's very definitely set in autumn 2020 during lockdown in France, and I've dealt with the issue of the virus and the pandemic, not in an obtrusive way, but in a background way, because after all, it is and has been the wallpaper of our daily lives for the last 12, 15 months. Mm. So it seemed that if I was writing a book in with a contemporary setting, I couldn't really ignore it. I enjoyed meeting up with him again, and it seems quite a few readers quite enjoyed reacquainting themselves with my old pal.
That's good. And Peter, you looked up then when you heard that the book was set in August 2020, you know, like, was that just a sort of wow, you know, so current, or you haven't known anyone?
Well, you're the first, Peter, you're the first writer I've heard who said they've set a book during the pandemic. I mean, I think every writer, mystery writer, what have you, has to make a sort of decision about how you're going to move forward with an event like COVID that has changed the wallpaper in all of our rooms. Like you said, I mean, are you going to ignore it? Are you going to set all your books in 2018? Are you going to just jump past it? So I'm sort of interested that you went for it. I mean, I just feel like so many of my books, for whatever reason, people are always meeting strangers in bars and, you know, right up next to each other, and people are going to offices, all the things that normally happen in my books, and you know, they don't happen anymore. So planes, I know, people talking together on planes. I mean, that's
on
over
planes.
With.
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine? I mean, it's ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. So, yeah. So I think my books will perpetually be set in 2018 from now on out. was it hard? Did you make lots of mentions to it, Peter? Or did you just sort of put it in the background?
I tried to keep it in the background and not to make an issue of it. It's just that these are the things that we have to deal with in daily life, the putting on of masks, taking off of masks, gelling hands.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the characters visits the Louvre, for example, and, you know, my research showed that the Louvre had instituted a one-way system around the museum so that people didn't encounter one another going in the opposite directions. You know, things like that, which... I thought it was quite interesting and lent a bit of colour to the book. And I actually, because the book was taking place largely in October, and the denouement was coming up, and the French government announced that France was going back into lockdown on the 31st of the month, I thought, oh, that will make everything not work for me if the story is taking place in November. So it has to be in October. And let's make use of the fact that we're going back into lockdown. It puts pressure on Enzo to solve the mystery, the crime, before lockdown basically stops his ability to move around.
It's actually like, it's almost like the restraints of COVID have sort of helped the story arc for you, Seth Peter. So you've used them to the best of your ability there.
I think you. Necessity is the mother of invention. I remember when I used to work in television, and we used to make a soap opera in Scotland, and I was story editor, and it was a small studio. You could only get four sets into the studio, and you could only change two of them every week. But there were different size sets just to complicate things, so they could only go in certain combinations. And you had also a list of cast who had been given contracts for so many episodes each. So you had to take all this information on board when you're basically creating your storylines, so that you have the set in which the action to take place, and the actors who are contracted are getting the proper number of storylines. So these pressures have nothing to do with the actual storytelling process, but they put such a pressure on you that they became a creative spur. They made you think outside the box, and I actually quite enjoyed that challenge.
Yeah, I think we might see a few more, especially in the sort of crime thriller genre. I think we might see a few more set in this last year. But let's
yeah. I mean, you could write a very good COVID thriller. I mean, you could take the isolation. The not seeing someone, being holed up in your homes, the change of, I mean, that could all be a great background to a sort of specific type of COVID thriller. I mean, it's similar in a way, I think, as a thriller writer, sometimes technology gets in the way, especially like cell phones, where you want someone in kind of danger and yet they have cell phones. So, I mean, you can do one of two things. You can sort of come up with a clunky device where that you're suddenly out of service, or they drop their cell phone or whatever. That's probably what I do most of the time. But and then or you can find a way to make a good modern thriller that utilizes the sort of creepiness of a cell phone, the fact that it's tracking you, the fact that you can get messages from people you don't know. I mean, there's you can kind of use it both ways. So
yeah. And Peter too. Let's talk about your latest novel. It's called Every Vow You Break. Just tease us with this a little bit. Tell us about Abigail and her story.
So Abigail is a slightly reluctant bride to be, who goes off on her bachelorette party. I believe you call them hen parties. and when she's there, she has a sort of drunken, ill-advised one-night fling with a stranger, with a man whose name she doesn't even get. And she kind of decides to put this behind her and go forward with the wedding and not tell her her groom. But this man shows up again in her life and sort of stalks her to her honeymoon. And then I think it takes some sort of left turns. I hope it does. It starts off as a sort of fatal attraction type of story, and then it sort of goes into different directions when she's arrives on this island where she's having her honeymoon. And again, and as I just pointed out, it is an island conveniently where they don't use cell phones. It's a no-tech island, which came in very handy as things got bad for Abigail.
Yeah. And you were like, oh yes, this is very good news for me.
Yes,
as I type more words on the page. your books have always, to me anyway, Peter, they've always been very filmic. I can always picture them, and I you were talking about Fatal Attraction there. Where did this particular germ of an idea, this heavyweight idea in the boxing ring, where did this one come from for you?
Well, this was a strange idea in the sense that it was more of the type of book that I wanted to write as opposed to the specific plot. I'd written several books that had that I think of as sort of more complex thrillers with multiple narrative perspectives. I often write books that bounce back and forth between points of view from different characters. Often we're seeing one event described in two different ways. I've also written a few books that have the timeline. So, you know, a book in which there are two timelines, one 20 years earlier and one now, and they sort of catch up with one another. And so I had for a while there wanted to write what I thought of, and I'm sort of getting a head start on the book off portion of this. I wanted to write what I considered an Ira Levin thriller. In other words, a thriller where, you know, it happens in sort of real time and you're just getting the perspective of one character. So essentially when you're reading this book, it is Abigail's story. When Abigail discovers something, you discover it as the reader. You don't have special information and she is simply sort of in peril and confused by what's going on and you're along the ride with her. It's a type of book that I wanted to do. And oddly enough, I don't know why I thought this. I thought this might be a little more simple or an easier type of book to write. And I don't think there is an easier type of thriller to write. I mean, they're all about structure and when to surprise your readers and all these difficult things that you have to put together. So, you know, it turned out to take me much longer. I wrote the first draft very fast and then the subsequent drafts just went on and on. But anyway, so it was the type of thriller I wanted to write more than the story itself.
Than an actual idea. Yeah. That's cool though. Because I suppose when you get to be able to write and publish, you know, more than a couple of books, get to your third or fourth or whatever it is, I suppose you have the luxury to a certain degree, don't you, of going, okay, what's the thing I want to do, what's the style I want to do, maybe if I want to break away from things I've done before, and that must be quite nice, I suppose.
I think I've gotten away with that a little bit. I think you know, I write standalones and I haven't written a series book, and although I think I can't help but write a book that sounds like me. I do try and mix it up and write, you know, some books that are more like a whodunit, some books that are more like a classic psychological thriller, or this book, which is more of a even a straight up thriller. And I was also rebelling against the idea of these lengthy thrillers. I mean, I've written several what I think of as a lengthy thriller, which is 80,000 to 100,000 words. But I do a lot of my reading is in mid-century crime thrillers, both English and American, or early part of the last century. And there's so many great classic mysteries that are really around 50,000, 60,000 words, which is actually a great length for a mystery. I mean, I think... you know, And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie, I think, clocks in about 60,000 words. And, she kills off all 10 of her characters. Sorry for the spoiler alert, but you should know that already. It's kind of in the title, so I don't feel too bad about it.
No, you shouldn't.
But anyway, you know, so I am sort of jealous of these, you know, sometimes you do have to have these complex backstories in your novels to get them up to around 80,000 words. But, you know, publishing trends come and go. And right now it's a longer thriller era we are in, for lack of a better word.
No, we'll take that. Longer
thriller era. Yeah.
Before we do the book off, I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying of late, so that, you know, we can get some other recommendations. And I know the listeners love to hear what might be out there, as well as your two fabulous books. Peter M., have you been able to, you know, I know some writers don't read so much when they are in that writing process, but have you been able to read now that the novel has been delivered?
Not a huge amount. I'm involved in building a summer kitchen in my garden at the moment, and that's been a wonderful escape from writing and words and things.
What's a summer kitchen?
Summer kitchen. Well, it's basically a kitchen which is semi outdoors, so that one can live most of the summer out of doors in the garden, in and out of the pool, barbecuing in the shade. It's all those lovely lifestyle things that we need, given the restrictions of the pandemic. It's the only thing that makes it bearable. But I have read a little. I've been making my way through the Slow Horses series, Mick Herron's books, which I understand they're currently filming for a BBC TV series.
They are.
Which I look forward. Gary Oldman playing the part of...
Absolutely.
I can't remember his name, the character, but...
Jackson Lamb.
Because... Jackson Lamb, that's who it is, yes. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing that. I've been enjoying the books. They're very different from the usual kind of thriller crime story or spy book. They make you laugh a lot, and they're quite shocking sometimes.
Yeah, they are.
And he has no compunction about killing off regular characters, which I love, because it means you never know. You just never know what he's going to do next. And so it creates that tension. But I've enjoyed them. They've been a great diversion for me, following the end of the writing and, working on the summer kitchen and, good. Yes, they're good. They're very good.
They are. And Mick was on this podcast just a few episodes ago, actually, talking about his latest one. Yeah. I completely agree. It's just the sort of the dark humour and some of the shock factor that I love too, actually, on those books, Peter. And what about you, Peter S? What have you been reading and enjoying recently, if indeed you have been?
Yeah, I've been doing a fair amount of reading. I always... As I said, I always read quite a bit of from dead authors, but a couple new books that I've enjoyed. I think I really liked Anthony Horowitz's latest, The Moonflower Murders, which are really fun. I mean, again, those are kind of plays on Golden Age mysteries. I enjoyed that one, and I enjoyed a debut novelist, Alex Pivese. I'm not sure I'm saying his name correctly, but he wrote a book called Eight Detectives. The Eighth Detective, depending on what country you're in, which was, again, another sort of clever take on Golden Age murder mysteries. And then in terms of older writers that I'm dipping into, I've been reading a lot of Josephine Tay, a fellow Scott, the sort of mysterious mystery writer. I think she wrote from sort of the 30s on through the 50s and 60s. I'm reading Miss Pym Disposes right now. She's very funny. She wrote about half dozen books or 10 books or something like that. And they're all quite different. They're all mysteries, but they're all have a very different feel. She's famous, of course, for Daughter of Time, the historical mystery in which her inspector is laid up in bed and delves into Richard III, I believe. His history. But anyway, so I've been enjoying those.
And her name again? So I don't
know. Josephine Tay. Her last name is T-E-Y.
E-Y.
Yeah.
My mother was a great fan of Josephine Tay. I remember rows of those books on the bookshelf in my house. My mother was a great reader and she loved those.
Yeah, they're terrific. They're very of their time and kind of jaunty in a way, but quite jaunty and cynical at the same time. They have a kind of 20s, 30s feel to them, but they also have a psychological depth that I think, she really led the way to sort of the Ruth Rendells and the P.D. James and, that bridge between Agatha Christie and them in terms of, she wrote about depression and psychological issues. I mean, she's very good.
Mm. That sounds great. Thank you for those.
And why didn't I pick her for my book off? I don't know. But I feel like I've just done a good job of selling her. So
it's almost like you're warming up, Peter.
I know.
What I mean? It's like you're sort of getting
I just hope I'm not I didn't sort of, you know, outdo myself and it's all gonna be a letdown from here. But
not at all, no.
We'll find out.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, indeed we will, because it is time for the book off. This is where each of you gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book that you really love and think that we should all read. You don't have to use your 3 minutes, guys, so don't feel like you have to sort of drag it out. But if you go over the 3 minute mark, we will be stopping you in your tracks, either with... I need to reach over here and get the bicycle or the school bell. So let's find out who's going to go first and who's going to go second. Peter 1, Peter M, would you like to go first or second?
I don't mind at all. I'm quite happy to go first.
You'll step up to the plate. Okay, very good. Yeah. And Peter Swanson, would you like to be honked out or rung out at your 3 minute mark?
Well, I think honked out.
Okay. That means, Peter May, you get the school bell, okay?
Okay.
As I say, you don't have to use them all, but you'll know when your time is up, when that comes clanging in. Before we start the timer, could you just tell us the book that you're going to be putting forward?
For me, it's The Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar B by J.P. Don Levy.
Oh, what a title. All righty. Well, I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock then, and you have 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us all about that book. Over to you.
Right. I was 18 years old and working as a cub reporter in my first job in newspapers when a colleague lent me this book. And I can say without equivocation that it changed my life. The story itself is at times deeply moving and at other times jaw-achingly funny. It is both life-affirming and tragic. And as a young man who had barely been out of Scotland and was just starting to make his way in the world, The Beastly Beatitudes introduced me to places and people beyond my ken. A character growing up in Paris, the son of wealth sent to boarding school in England, then cutting his teeth on life and love at Trinity College Dublin. The pain of finding love, then losing it in the most devastating of circumstances. It made me weep unashamedly and made me laugh until it hurt. It did everything a good story should do. It engaged all my emotions. But more than that, it was deliciously liberating. in a way that would have earned the disapproval of my English teacher father and the succession of English teachers at school who spent 12 years dinning the rules of grammar into my thick skull, because J.P. Dunleavy broke them all. Not because he didn't know them, of course he did, but it was that knowledge that gave him the confidence to break them and gave me the confidence to follow his example. Sentences don't need verbs. Nouns don't need adjectives. And sometimes adjectives don't need nouns. Words should not only communicate, they should make music. In combination, they create cadence and melody. They provide a rhythm for the narrative. They should never get in the way or become more important than the story. One critic described Dunleavy's writing as an intricate prose style characterized by minimal punctuation, strings of sentence fragments, frequent shifts of tense and lapses from standard third-person narration into first-person stream of consciousness. Without Dunleavy's example, I would never have written The Black House, which alternates between third and first-person narration, exploring themes of love and human frailty, regret and betrayal. And I have running battles with copy editors on every manuscript I write over my sentence fragments and tense shifts. But you don't have to be a writer to be moved and inspired by the beastly Beatitudes. Indulge yourselves. Wallow in the poetry of the prose, the humanity of its characters, and the power of its storytelling. You won't regret it.
Oh, fantastic. 2.5 minutes, Peter. Look at that. Wow. Boom. Mic drop out of there. Whoa. Love that pitch. Want to come back and talk about it in just a moment. Take a breather, have a rest. And we're going to put 3 minutes back on the clock for you, Peter Swanton. Before we start that, just tell us the book that you're putting forward.
The book I'm putting forward is A Kiss Before Dying by the aforementioned Ira Levin.
3 minutes over to you, Peter.
Well, first off, I want to say a little bit about Ira Levin's career and how incredibly I'm not jealous of writers in general, but I'm very jealous of Ira Levin's career. So I think he only wrote about 8 novels, but each one is this sort of brilliant constructed idea. I'm sure people are aware of him because of Rosemary's Baby, which to me is the best horror suspense novel ever written. And not only that, but it was turned into, I think, my favorite horror film of all time, the 68 version with Mia Farrow is terrific. He also came up with Stepford Wives, which is ridiculous but incredibly fun, and Boys from Brazil, another great sort of semi-science fiction, semi-supernatural suspense novel. And then the other thing that Ira Levin did, which I'm very jealous of, because it's sort of my pipe dream, is he wrote a great stage thriller called Death Trap. In fact, I think that's one of the hardest genres to write, evidenced by the fact that there are so few great ones. I mean, I think there's Wait Until Dark, Dial M for Murder, Angel Street, and Death Trap is just one of the best. But I'm going to talk about his first book, his debut novel, which is a sort of straight-up psychological thriller called A Kiss Before Dying. It's about a young man named Bud Corliss, who is a sociopath who dreams, a working-class sort of sociopath in America who dreams of making himself better off, rising in the social ranks. It's a truly great book, and I'm going to give a few little reasons that I've written down. First of all, it has murder mystery elements, but it's basically a why done it as opposed to a who done it, and it's very psychologically astute and does an amazing job of sort of getting into Bud's brain space. It's filled with surprises, but it has one of the all-time great twists that sort of happens midway through the book, and I guarantee you will never see it coming. I love the structure of this book because it's Bud's involvement with three separate women, and each and they're sisters, and there are three sections in the book, and in each section is his sort of interaction with his sister. And each section itself is almost like a little thriller. So there's rising tension at the end of each section. And then you sort of have almost a climax to the story, and then you go into the next section. So it's almost like three little thrillers in one, which is brilliant. Oh, I knew I was going to run out of time. Oh, I sensed it as I was rambling on. I think, Peter, you timed yourself out quite brilliantly. I think you had practiced a little more than me. So
I have to say, I was glancing down at the clock at about 2.5 minutes, thinking, I know he's got a lot more to say here.
I really, yes, I should have practiced more. But anyway, I hope I got my point across.
I think you very much did.
I kept mine down to 2.5 minutes so that you could have another 30
no,
seconds.
No,
you
that,
needed no. It. That's how it's working, is it? Sharing the time.
It. You're being too kind.
Thank you both for those, because they were really great. And Peter, we could have, you know, listened on, because I was totally engrossed. Let me talk about Don Levy's book first. What an opening to say essentially it changed your life, Peter. I mean, you know, when a book has had that effect, that's, you've got to sit up and listen. But I love the description of it. I don't know this book. I don't know either of these books, I have to say. Jaw-achingly funny and also made you weep. And you kind of think, wow, okay, if a book's got that in it, that's quite a skill, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was the first of his books that I read. And I read his other work, and I don't think he ever came quite as close to the perfection that he achieved in the Beastly Beatitudes.
He wrote The Ginger Man, right?
Yes.
Oh, well.
The Ginger Man was, I think it was an earlier book, and I think he kind of borrowed a little from The Ginger Man for Beastly Beatitudes.
Well, that's the book of his that I quite love, but I haven't read your, but yeah, I love Ginger Man.
Right. Well, I suppose having read Baltazar first, I didn't enjoy Ginger Man nearly as much. I should probably have read them the other way around. But Beatitudes was just, literally reduced me to tears at times. There was a chapter end in that book that was like an arrow through the heart. It was so painful. And I suppose you could have seen it coming, but you just didn't want it to happen. And moments of such Tom Sharp-esque farce that just, you know, belly laughs. You're sitting in a room on your own, roaring and laughing. And I think any writer who can take you from, you know, one extreme to the other like that is got some extraordinary ability.
Oh, completely. And also the fact that, you know, you said he broke the rules because it reminded me of Les Dawson, who was such an amazing pianist and yet played the piano badly, but you can only play it that badly and get those laughs if you are good enough. And I know, and so exactly, that sort of rule-breaking comparison about the fact that you said that he knew what he was doing, but he did his own thing, and that just made me think, yeah, I love that.
It was a revelation to me at the time when I was maybe 19 years old, an aspiring writer, just starting out, and the fact that you here was somebody who was breaking all the rules, the golden rules. That my father was an English teacher, you know, and I used to give him my early manuscripts to read, and he would mark them up in the margins like my English teacher, you know, correcting my spelling and my punctuation and stuff. So I was brought up with, he wrote the definitive English grammar book that was used in schools in the 60s. I was brought up with these, and they were like a straitjacket. Yeah. And reading Don Levy was so liberating. I just suddenly realized, oh, yeah, I know all this stuff, but, you know, I can be free of it if I want. Yeah. It was a revelation.
Totally. And Peter, to your book of choice, I think what was nice about your pitch, even though it meant you slightly ran out of time, is that you gave quite a lot of context for IRA 11, which I think is good, because I don't think I'd realised quite how much he'd done and almost how little he'd done, because you said only 8 novels, but yet, you know, it sounds like he's just hit a winner every time. And this being the debut, it's quite an interesting choice then to you know, of all the 8, to go with this one. But it sounds fascinating.
Well, it's sort of in my genre. I mean, psychological thriller. And what's interesting to me is he wrote that as his debut, and I think he kind of hit it out of the park, and then never wrote another straight up thriller like that again. He sort of went on to different areas. So I'm sort of impressed by that. Maybe he just felt like he got it right, because it really is a surprising and devious book.
And you've definitely made me want to read it because of the twist now.
Yeah, and it was made into a couple fairly mediocre films, but one in 1956 with Robert Wagner, who played a very good young psychopath, and then made in early 90s film with Matt Dillon, neither of which are particularly good, but the book is terrific.
Oh, well, I love the description of the, you know, that it's almost like 3 little thrillers in, or you know, little thrillers in each section. You know, that in itself makes me think, wow, that's a skill.
I love that so much about that book, and I think that's what really struck me, to the point where I basically kind of stole that idea for my second novel, The Kind Worth Killing, which has a similar structure. So it's just quite brilliant. It doesn't have I mean, I think sometimes with thrillers, you get a little bit of that. You see how the thing's unfolding. And by the time you get to the big finish, you're kind of, you kind of know where it's going to wind up. And this is a book that you never know where it's going to wind up.
Yeah.
Did Ira Levin write a book called something like This Perfect Day?
Yeah. So it's a dystopian future book, which is actually, very few people know that. And it's very good. I mean, it's you know, like all his books.
I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's been sort of forgotten. So he dipped his toe in a lot of things, and one of them was a dystopian sort of science fiction novel. Again, he only wrote one. This Perfect
Amazing
Day.
Though, because that I really don't think that happens much or has happened much with one author to do such a range of different genres, but only do one in each genre. You know, that's quite rare, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it is very rare, and I think he also, I mean, he came up through television, and then through playwriting, and he wrote a number of teleplays as well, and the sort of America in the 50s when they were doing all the plays on television. So maybe he was sort of an idea guy, and he would come up with one great idea, and then do it, and then, you know. But it's remarkable. I mean, all his books are good, except for the last one, which is a sequel to Rosemary's Baby, which you are both recommended to avoid at all costs.
To be honest, I feel like I probably could have said I'll avoid that based on the fact that it's a sequel to Rosemary's Baby.
I don't know the situation. Maybe he needed money. I don't know.
But hey, maybe so. But
he needed to make himself a summer kitchen.
But we'll definitely be checking out A Kiss Before Dying, though. And Rosemary's Baby is great. That's the only one of his I've read, I think. Thank you both for these pitches. I love them both. I want to read both of these books now, which is always a sign that, you know, that you've said all the right things. But I got to pick one to take home. Toughy though, and I think today I'm going to take J.P. Donnelly. The Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar B. Have I said that right, Pete?
Beatitudes,
sorry. I knew I wouldn't get it right.
It's such a great title.
It is a great title, yeah.
Really, it is a great title. Yes, I'm any book that can make you weep and then make you laugh is just right. You know, right up my street. Having said that, I've got to read a bit more IO 11. So thank you for flying the flag for him, Peter. The Night Gate by Peter May is out now. It's published by River Run, and Every Vow You Break by Peter Swantz is also out now. That's published by Faber. They are both absolutely fabulous reads, and we suggest you get yourselves a copy so that you can enjoy them as much as we have. Peter, what an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your recommendations, and I hope that very soon we'll all be able to be in the same place. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
It would be nice.
That would be great. Yeah.
But thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.